Welcome to Chatting with Ingram. I'm Philip Ingram, and today I'm talking to the Irish journalist and broadcaster Angela Doyle Stewart, who has just published her new book, The Sunday Morning Cure. Her tragic journey is inspirational and fascinating. Angela, can you introduce yourself to our listeners today?
I am a journalist. I broadcast news on a radio station, and I also have a newspaper column. I would have published my first book in 2012, Loving Lisa, Stolen Lives, Stolen Dreams, a memoir about my sister who was murdered in Ireland. Her killer is currently serving, you know, probably gone through nearly 12 years of his life sentence in Ireland. And then I would have, a book would have come out at that time. It was a bestseller in Ireland. And
now you've just written another book and it's all about anxiety. Are you a nervous person?
So, yeah, I wouldn't be a nervous person. So for me, I've been on live TV. I've done loads of stuff work-wise. So I wouldn't be the type of person that would get nervous. So I think people sometimes have this idea that a person that gets social anxiety in some situations must be somebody that's introverted and hides away. I'm not. I'm an extrovert. I could stand up in front of an audience of 1,000 and it wouldn't bother me. I wouldn't get nervous. So because that's a controlled environment, to me, that's a safe environment. Me being on live TV, safe. But you bring me into a pub situation where people are falling around and possibly drinking near me and unpredictable, I suddenly feel nervous. And that's obviously connected to the murder of my sister because that was so unpredictable and traumatic. And I had carried that with me, you know, in social events where people made me nervous. And it wasn't people's fault. Nobody ever did anything to hurt me around me. They were always... Yep. People were lovely and genuinely nice drunks around me, you know. And but at the same
time, the Irish are renowned for producing nice drunks.
Yeah, but we're also, I think people have this idea that we just love drinking and that's all we are. There's so much more to Ireland, as you know. So, but for me, that was probably the reason I did drink in social situations. And when I connected the dots and went, hold on a minute. I don't need alcohol because I'm not lacking in confidence. I could talk to anybody. So why am I drinking? I don't really enjoy it. I didn't start drinking until I was 27 either. That's another thing. I wasn't a teenage drinker. I wasn't an early 20. Went through college, did everything non-drinkers, played sports, did all of that. Took it up at 27. And then when I realized as I'm out with all my friends and going, I'm getting so bored. I want to go. I kept saying to them, let's go different places. And they kept going, what's wrong with you? You know, we're here. We've just gotten here. And this was when I realized I got very hyper with drinking me and I got very bored and I couldn't concentrate on what people were saying to me. And I was very pleasant and friendly, but I wasn't good company because I was so impatient. I was so hyper, like, you know, that's the way alcohol would affect me. That I wanted them to finish what they were saying. You know, I would be like, you know, I couldn't concentrate. And that to me was concerning because I thought, hold on a minute, that's not good company for anybody. You know, you can't be with these people and, you know, expect, you know, them to just decide you call the shots here and be so demanding. That's not how it works. And also because of the anxiety, I just thought, I can't do it anymore. Today's drink is tomorrow's anxiety and it's a full day of it. And I just couldn't do it. And you know what? It's about being kind to yourself. I mean, I just like being, and you know what? I think people hide behind, you know, their crutch, you know, the alcohol and stuff like that. And I was hiding behind that because I wasn't allowing the uncomfortable feelings to come to the surface. I was kind of kept pushing them back down with the alcohol when we were out. And really, I just needed to sit there. And obviously, I've since sat there in social situations and will again, where at first I feel awkward because, you know, everyone else is drinking around me. But then I settle into it very quickly and I go, oh my God, I feel so great. And I feel like people get that I'm engaging with them. And then I also know I can get the hell out of here if I'm not happy. So, and that's it. There's a freedom in that. And I've found since I've become a non-drinker, people are more respectful towards me. Not that I was disrespectful to them, but I mean, people, they, like even like in a restaurant or in I was at a wedding last August, the management couldn't have been nicer to me. And I think because they knew I was the girl that wasn't drinking. And, you know, people have a little bit more, I don't know. They know, first of all, they can't be rude to you because you'll remember it.
Yes, exactly.
But also, there's a nicer feeling. I think there's a respect there. And I feel that way when I'm around other people that can sit in a crowd and not feel the need to drink. Now, I'm not saying people feel the need to drink either. You know, it's just a personal choice. For me, it just impacted me.
But it's becoming, you know, non-drinking is becoming more acceptable. You're even seeing in the Six Nations, whenever the adverts are coming out and you're getting Guinness Clear being advertised, which, you know, is fantastic. And for, you know, anyone that's listening, you want a pint of Guinness Clear. It is one of the best Irish drinks that you can get if you can get the proper spring water.
Yeah, isn't that brilliant? You see, that's exactly it. More and more companies are bringing out non-alcoholic drinks and they are killing it. It's brilliant. I love seeing that. I love seeing that. And more, the younger generation that's coming up actually are drinking a lot of non-alcoholic drinks, apparently. And a survey that was carried out in 2020 found that 49%, a global survey found that 49% of women in Ireland did not like having drank the night before. It was a big regret for them. So that's half, you know, when you think about it.
Now, there's two things that come out of what you're talking about there. One, you said early on that there was a physical reason that your drink had that effect on you. And the second thing is, do you feel that you had a sort of professional mask that you put on when you were doing things from a professional perspective so that that's what gave you the confidence? Because I found, you know, whenever I went through my mental health issues that it was very easy for me in the environment that I was in to put this mask on because I wore a uniform, I had a status, I had everything else, and therefore I could pretend like the actor on the stage and push this front, and I almost lived that most of the time, and even I didn't realize the real me underneath that and what was going on inside me. Have you found that as well?
Yeah, first of all, I don't know how you did it, because in your environment and in your profession, that had to have been huge, you know, and I know some of your story, obviously, but like I think that takes incredible courage, especially as you're saying, when you're going through so much internally. So, you know, so much respect for you, how you handled that. For me, you're right. Absolutely. Do you know what it was? It was that professionally, exactly that. It wasn't personal. It was professional. So nobody got to see beneath what was really going on for me. It wasn't exposing, you know, there was no part of me exposing the vulnerability within me, the truth of who I was, where I was feeling. And I didn't like myself. You know, when you have, particularly in my case, with my sister being murdered, that had a huge traumatic effect on me. It wasn't just from the state of the trauma, something so huge and so unimaginable. It was also, it made my confidence hit rock bottom. Mm. So I could still, like that, like the actor, put the brave face on for my work. I mean, I went back to work 3 weeks after Lisa was murdered. I went on, the leading TV show in Ireland, The Late Late, to talk about my book. And the reason I wrote my book was because another journalist had poached me in the newspaper I was working in, a national journalist, a lovely girl. She was writing a book about a few different women that had been murdered, young women had been murdered in our country.
And when did this happen? So, you know, because people out there...
My book, Lisa, was murdered in 2009. And my book came out in 2012. Which in one way, when I look back now, was quite soon. But I think what happened was when she contacted me and said that she was going to write the book and could I give her some information? And I thought at the time, being a journalist too, if anyone was going to write my sister's book, it was going to be me.
Yeah.
And, you know, not somebody else. And actually in the end, she connected me with the publisher she was in discussions with. And I actually let those publishers go because we had a different vision of what my book would be. Mm-hmm. Theirs was a crime book. Mine was a memoir. And in the end, the right editor and publisher found me and it became a memoir. And they were lovely people. They just had a different vision. There was nothing wrong with them or their vision. It just wasn't suitable for my vision. And I'm a big believer, if I'm going to do something, it has to feel right to me, because, you know, it's important to be in alignment with it. But because of that, I could really be professional. I could keep it together. Mm-hmm. I've never lost my mind. I mean, I've never, in all the traumas and everything that's thrown at me, I am amazed sometimes I've kept my mind, if that makes sense, that that's kept together. But anxiety is huge, because anxiety is trauma unreleased. So it hasn't been released in your body. You know this. So for me, I could turn it on. I can get out there and I can play the role. And that's what I was playing. But getting personal in a personal situation, a one-on-one and stuff, and being with other people, it used to be very difficult for me. You know, because I didn't want to be feeling so exposed in who I was.
Your sister's murder wasn't the only tragedy that you've suffered. And when it comes to then anxiety and how that impacts not just on you, but on those that are around you, how did you find that, you know, that worked? And can you explain, if you don't mind, to those that are listening, your next tragedy?
Well, my mother had died first before Lisa. She died from sudden adult death syndrome. I was 23 at the time, and Lisa was living with me in Dublin. I was working in EMI, you know, the record label at the time. I'd left RT and I'd went to EMI and I was working with them. And Lisa was training to be a hairstylist in a leading hair salon in Dublin. And Mammy died. She was 53. She went to sleep and she didn't wake up. Mm. And I had some strange experiences before my mother died. Like that I'd seen my mother 2 weeks before, which I kind of wrote a little bit about in my book, but I didn't delve into it because I wanted to be more so focused on Lisa. But the 2 weeks before my mother died, I hugged her. And I, as I was hugging her, I got this terrible feeling that I wasn't going to see her again.
Yeah.
It was really strange. And I remember getting into the car with my friend at the time and said, I think my mother's going to die. And he looked at me and he said, what? What are you on about? And I said, I have this terrible feeling that's the last time I'm going to see my mother. Hmm. And he just kind of said, she'll outlive us all. Would you stop, you know, get over it. But then my mommy died on the 11th of December. It was a Wednesday night. I was working in the record label. I came home. Lisa and I were doing laundry every Wednesday night. I said, do you mind doing it on your own? I need to be on my own tonight. So I went to a little coffee shop where you couldn't get a phone signal. And I sat there for over an hour. When I got out, all these missed calls. You know, for my sister, my father and everything else. And my mother had died. You know, so that for me was probably a huge part of, you know, the realization that people that you love are there and then they're gone, you know, in an instant it happens. And then 7 years after Lisa died, well, Lisa was murdered. And then 7 years after Lisa, myself and Stephen, we lost a little baby girl in pregnancy, you know, halfway through the pregnancy. Well, a first scan was fine. And then the second scan, they said, you know, have you got abnormalities or, what was it?
Chromosomal abnormalities.
Yeah. They have got them in your family. And I thought, no, we don't. And I knew then we did, you know, in that moment that I did.
Yeah.
And she couldn't say much more. She said, look, I need to send you over to the person that does the specialized scans. We went over. She said, look, there's something going on. The baby has a big cyst, you know, on the back of their neck. And this usually indicates a major heart defect or a chromosomal abnormality or both. Yeah. And it turned out we were sent to Dublin and kind of back and forth for 6 weeks. She and we took loads of testing and we found out we were having a little girl and that she had Down syndrome and a major heart defect as a result. So that was tough. I found that hard. You know, I found it really difficult because before we went for the scan, I remember sitting on the bed feeling that I was really angry. This is before I knew anything. And we had planned the baby, you know, it was a very much wanted pregnancy. But I remember sitting there and texting my sister going, why do I feel so mad? I'm really angry today about the pregnancy and I don't know why. So she was like, oh, it's probably just because you're going for a scan and you're apprehensive. You know, we had no problems in our previous pregnancy. So I don't know, I went in and then when she told me, well, actually, I prayed, believe it or not. I just said, I just need to be really present in my life. I'd love to be really present because I feel like I'm not so present anymore in my life. And I just thought the cruelty of that and the irony in one way, because I couldn't have been more present once I found out that I had a pregnancy, a baby who every week I would find out whether she would live or die. And that went on for 6 weeks. It was like, you know, they wouldn't tell us. They just kept saying, we don't know. And I just thought I had to take every day, literally day by day. And the strangest feeling, knowing that I had a little life inside of me. I think that was the hardest part, knowing that I was powerless. There was nothing I could do. And that was the hardest part because I just felt I can't save her. There's nothing I can do for her, you know, and I would pray. And, you know, and I would play music to her. You know, I put my phone up and I play all these different songs that made me feel good. And I do all of that kind of stuff and I talk to her. But I think I knew. And when the final appointment, I knew when we went in that morning, I just said, you know, she's not going to live. It was just the knowing. And when they said, look, we're so sorry. It could be weeks or it could be a matter of hours. And the next day I had this lovely experience. I dropped my son off to preschool. And as I was walking, I just, you know, some people think feathers and stuff. And I'm not really big into the whole feather thing. You know, you see a feathered angel. Mm-hmm. But it was something really strange about this day. I was walking and it was so beautiful and sunny. And next minute, this like white feather floated in front of me. This tiny little white feather. Mm-hmm. And it was like it hovered, which is really strange. And I reached out and I put my hand out for it and it fell into my hand. And I just thought, there was something physically changed within my body. It sounds, I know, very spiritual and very strange, but I could feel like a change. And I just thought, goodbye, you know.
Yeah.
I love you. Goodbye. Thank you for being here. And that was it. And then when I went to the hospital, the following week. So literally that was a Tuesday, the following Tuesday. And the girl that was taking her sonogram said, you know, the baby, she's, you know, she's died, probably judging by measurements of possibly just a week ago. And I said, yeah, you know, and I knew that it was just that lovely experience that I had, which was, you know, an opportunity to say goodbye. And then I said, I'd never have children again. That was it. I was scarred. And I blamed myself though. I thought it was my fault because, you know, I was over 35. And I remember saying to the doctor as we went in to have an assisted loss, you know, to go through it. And I said, you know, I think it's my fault. And he said, well, how is it your fault? I said, well, I'm over 35. He said, nonsense. He said, most babies, you know, that don't are born to women under 35. Not that there's anything wrong. I mean, I was very happy to have my baby with Down syndrome, with any illness. Mm-hmm. Once my baby was coming into the world, I would have gone and done everything for her and I would have minded her. And I was actually quite, because I thought when I heard Down syndrome, that meant she would survive. And I was quite excited about that. I thought, okay, I'm going to have a little girl. You know, I was excited to have a little girl. And I looked up all the research about Down syndrome, where I could get supports, what I needed to do. Mm-hmm. To make sure that she had the best life and that her needs were taken care of. So I had already done the research thinking I was going to, you know, in one way be able to do that. But look, it didn't happen. And I had to accept it. It took me a while to accept it. And I was traumatized from it because I thought I blamed myself, even though I know it wasn't my fault. But, and I didn't do anything wrong. I'm always healthy in my pregnancies. And then he said, we'd never get pregnant again. And that was it. There was no way I was going through that because it was horrendous. And anyone that's gone through that, having to constantly go for the testing and the uncertainty. But 6 months later, I just thought, I need to do this. I need to do it. And then I did it. And then, because I had no problems getting pregnant, I got pregnant straight away. And when I went for the test, the doctor said, why don't you get loads of testing? You know, we can do that. And I'm like, I don't want any testing. If my baby's living, that baby's living with me, regardless of what the baby has. So I said, I've made this decision. So this decision is based on whatever my baby comes in with, I will accept. Lucas came into the world. He came in walking at 9.5 months, preachly talking. Talking at 8 months, saying, hot tea, mammy, at 8 months, standing beside me. I have the video. It kind of freaks me out a little bit, how bright he is. He's full on, but yeah, he's got his wits about him. So, and he's thankfully, he's 3.5 now and he's never been sick. I've never had him in the hospital. There's never been any issues. I think he's had one antibiotic in his whole life so far. So we're doing good. And Lucas means the giver of light, the illuminated one. Yep. So he brought joy back into the family.
And you know, how do all these traumas that you've suffered and have been very personal to you, apart from, you know, loss of your daughter, impacts you and your husband? You know, how does that impact the wider family? How have they managed to take with it and deal with you within that environment?
See, I've shielded them from it. If that's, you know. Like, don't get me wrong, my older son, I remember one day he came in and he said, Mammy, are you crying? And I thought about it for a second. I said, I can lie to him right now and say, Mammy's not crying. So I can protect him in one way from my tears. And in the other way, I said, well, crying is normal and it's a healthy emotion. And my child needs to know that it's okay to cry. And I said, you know what? Mammy's crying today, but Mammy's going to be okay. I've just felt a little bit sad there, but I'm still good. But it's actually good to release the tears. And it's really important that if you're not feeling 100% and you feel a little bit sad, that you know you can come and cry to me. So I think that helped him. And, you know, I think sometimes my mother, I never seen her cry in my life. So I remember thinking, and I remember when she'd find out siblings had died and stuff, and I'd be looking for a reaction as a child, waiting to see would she cry, and she never did. And I felt that was her way of trying to protect us. But, you know, it would have been good to see the, you know, the healthy emotion, which is, yes, it's okay not to have a good day. And if we don't show our children that that's normal, then how will they repress their feelings? Will they withhold those feelings? Whereas my son is so vocal about how he feels and he's so honest and open. And I love that about him. And I feel like in one way I played a part in that. But he's seen me go through. My father died, you know, 5 months after we had Lucas. You know, he went into hospital in November thinking he had a cold. And within 3 weeks, they said, you know, you've stage 4 terminal lung cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
You've got weeks to live. But he was so stubborn, he lived for another 3 months. So we watched that as it, you know, went, as he, you know, and I was with him most days and, you know, bringing in Lucas to him. And then, he died. And it was just a different death because it was, you know, you had the months leading up to it. You were able to talk. I was able to have some conversations with him. And, you know, it was just completely different. And I spoke at his funeral, whereas I couldn't speak at all the other funerals.
Yeah.
You know,
Have you found as you've gone through these traumas and bits and pieces that persona that you used to put on, that front and the real you have actually started to come together, and you're finding that that front that you could put on actually is the real you now, and you've got this new found confidence and belief in yourself and understanding of how everything works together for you?
Your questions are so interesting. You're brilliant. I love them. Yeah, they are. Because you know what stopped, what changed for me was the pretense. I just don't want to pretend anymore. Yeah. It is what it is. And I feel I have a duty as well. If I'm going to be vocal about something, I have to be open and honest about it and to be vulnerable and not to be afraid of vulnerability. That's a huge thing. And I think you set other people free when you're open. So yeah, I'm an open book. If I'm having a crappy day, and I'm not, I will say it. I'm not afraid to say I have been on my knees. I have prayed because the thoughts of getting through all these tough times felt like just huge to me. You know, there was never a part of me that wanted to end anything in my life, but there was a huge part of me that felt angry that I had to be the one to carry it. I was so mad, you know, and now I'm just like, yeah, I'm amazed. Sometimes, you know, my therapist said, he said, you're so grounded, Angela, you're so solid. And I find that strange when I'm told that, because I often wonder, where did he get that? And he'll say, no, you are grounded. Yeah. He said, it's amazing feeling.
Yeah, I describe after I went through mine, and people can look at other podcasts to find out what happened to me. But, you know, I describe that I've got proper me back. But proper me is not who I was before I went through all my traumas. I'm completely different. The proper me is me now, where I understand where I fit in and where everything works together. And I'm happy with, you know, my place, and I'm not trying to do anything, and I'm pretending, and I haven't got fronts on. It's, you know, what you see is what you get, effectively.
You don't have a front on. And I've noticed that about you when, you know, when I've looked at your work and your interviews and everything, you were very open. There's no fear in you. I've noticed that. And I admire that. There's a part of you that just says it. And you're exactly that. You're not trying to sugarcoat it for people. You're not trying to, I don't mean this impress people, like as an, it's not for you. I don't mean that like in a, you're not trying to impress people. You're very polite. I mean, you're very kind. You're, you know, you're all, I can see all of those things, but I just love that you're just so like, this is it. This is who I am. And I'm not going to, as you said, sugarcoat it.
As you've seen, you know, life's too short, and you never know what's around the corner. So there's no point. And I don't believe that I wasted all those years where that front was on. You know, I was that person until all the traumas happened to me, and you know, I went through, you know, the real difficulties. But and the falling apart over, you know, it was a long period of time. It was very painful indeed. And you know, almost as I'm sure you've seen, I don't know whether you're with yourself, but certainly with other people, almost life ending. But when you get through that and you get proper you back, it's almost like an enlightenment. It's strange. It's very difficult to describe, and people who haven't been through it, I don't think, can properly understand it.
Camille, what do you think it was for you that brought you back to you? Like, I know it was a series, but what do you think? I know you're saying it's very difficult to describe because you're going through it. But what do you think was that moment where it hit you that you just knew that it was a different, you were back to who you needed to be?
I think it was a number of different things all coming together. It was finding a life that I felt comfortable in. It was accepting everything that went on and not trying to put blame against it. And it was realizing that actually, and I go back to something that I can't remember who mentioned it to me, but it was described as a knight in shining armor syndrome. So you're out there and you're always trying to protect other people, and you're always going forward and you're saying, I can fix this, I can do that. And it's actually, it was probably through my therapy, the realization that no, you can't. And every now and again, you have to ask for help. And there's nothing wrong with asking for help. and listening and getting through that. And I think it's whenever, you know, I got that realization that actually I needed to ask for help, and that help allowed me to look at things in a way that I probably knew I needed to look at them that way, but you know, it was always put into the no, I can deal with this. I've got you know, and that knight in shining armor syndrome, and it's getting through that. And you know, when that came in, and can I put an exact point on it or an exact activity? Not really. I think it was just, I was fortunate in you know, everything coming together at the same time, both you know, personally, professionally to a degree, but also from a treatment perspective.
Yeah. And you know what? I'd imagine a lot of men who are listening to you right now, particularly men, because they have that knight in shining armor, they wear that well, and they think they have to be the ones to keep it together and fix it. And I think a lot of people will get comfort out of knowing that actually it's okay to ask for help. It's okay not to fix everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's where we start. I would have done the same. I would have been running around trying to keep everybody else together because I thought I was the strongest out of all, you know, that I was keeping it together and helping everybody keep it together when I was exhausted. By the end.
What kept you together?
Writing. Writing okay. And focus. For me, it's always been about focus and projects. I used to challenge myself every year. I would find something to pour my energy into. So I get these, I get really high energy and like bursts of energy, which I have to.
I'd have never guessed.
But I watch that now because I could take on stuff and I wouldn't be. I've gotten smart over the last year or maybe the last 2 years where I only take on so much now. But before then, I would be trying to do so much and I would be worn out and I would be miserable. And actually, so I used to every year in Lisa's memory, take on a new project and I would start something and I would give it. It would be like the project that year, whether it would be talks or a show or something. And then once I poured my energy into that, it was like it would get me through the suffering. But really what I was doing is denying a lot of the suffering. And I kind of made the connection that this time I'm not going to take on something new as such. I'm going to sit with the feelings. And I'm not going to exhaust myself this year. I'm just not exhausting myself. I mean, at one point I was, you know, getting up, I was running a newsroom, you know, on a radio station, managing a large team and getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, driving to work, not getting home until 3:45 in the daytime, doing homework with the kids, getting dinner ready and then going again. And I'm like, what am I doing? I can't do this. Why am I even doing this? Did I take this job because of the title? Did I really want to be a head of news, you know, on current affairs? Does that even interest me? And as I sat there, I went, I don't even enjoy it. I loved the people. Yeah. I mean, the people I worked with, but I didn't actually want the title and I didn't need the title. And that's for me, probably in the last year, what's really been a big moment for me in my life is actually realizing, first of all, things I used to work towards before, titles and all of that, no longer interest me.
Yeah.
I couldn't care less. That's the freedom. And I'm just, sometimes I go, so what's going to motivate me now? What will I do? Because before it used to be about how people perceived me and what I achieved and, you know, a long list of accolades. I needed to have all those things. And then it just hit me. Well, you can't bring anything with you. You know, none of this will matter in the end. So it's really about relationships. I try to invest my energy now into the people around me and the people that matter rather than some project, you know, or something that, yeah, it might enhance somebody else's life by doing a project. But at the same time, what about my life now? So not being selfish, I'm trying to be a little bit more self-loving. So that's what's changed.
Well, I actually, I can resonate with that. It's I think moving into understanding who I was, and liking myself, and until I understood who I was and liked myself, there's no way I could expect anyone else to understand me and like me. And that was a difficult journey, very difficult journey.
I can't imagine people not liking you though. I can't imagine that.
There's a few around.
But they're everywhere, right? And that's the thing. As Brené Brown said, if you're not willing to get into the arena and get your ass kicked, you know, when we're putting ourselves out there and if people want to criticize that, you know, and she's experienced that and I love her work. And she talks about how other people, if they're not willing to jump in there and get their ass kicked too and be vulnerable, then don't bring your opinions to me. Don't bother.
Exactly. And every now and again, and this isn't a particularly good trait, but you know, I know all the people that, especially in social media, who are going to jump on the bandwagon of something and start shouting at me and all the rest of it. And I get, there's a fantastic saying by a British Army general who commanded the British Army division going into Iraq in the first Iraq war. And he said, whenever you don't know what the enemy are doing, it's like a completely still pond. So don't be afraid to take a rock and throw it in and watch what happens to the ripples. And therefore, you know, every now and again, yeah, if I get completely bored on it, I'm just being bad for the sake of being bad. I'll throw a rock into the a social media pool and just watch Twitter light up and just sit there and smile and go, oh well, okay, I've done that. That's just a little bit of self satisfaction at doing it.
See, I'd like to be more like you that way. I'd like a little bit of that. Whereas I'm actually the opposite. I'm like, I just couldn't be bothered taking on anger of other people's anger. I'm not able for it. It's just like, oh, I can't. But so I love when there's somebody like you who's actually so not afraid to kind of be spontaneous and test the waters and challenge people's thinking. And if it means bringing out what's already inside, you know, Wayne Dyer talks about that. The late Wayne Dyer talks about how, you know, you squeeze the orange, you're only going to get orange juice that's going to come out of that orange. Yeah. So when people say, oh, he made me angry. No, the anger was already there. He just brought it out in you. So when somebody is riling you up and you're getting a reaction, then you have to ask yourself, where's the trigger? What happened there that brought that out in you? Because it was always there, you know. So
the best feature on Twitter whenever you do that and you get bored with it, because you do it and you get bored with it, it's just the mute button. So you hit mute and everyone else doesn't realize that you've left the conversation and they're still ranting and raving and everything else, and it's brilliant.
I didn't even know that. I love that. You see, I'm really bad. I only kind of went back into social media in 2019, and I didn't realize until the other day I had locked my Twitter account, and I only started that, and I started kind of, I suppose, because of the book, selfishly, was kind of become active on it a few months ago. And now I'm learning about it, but I find the trends a little bit addictive. I'm like, I never Instagram or Facebook, but there's something about Twitter. I'm like, all these trends, what's going on? And then the anger. Oh, Jesus, there's so much anger on Twitter. I can't get over it.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. But the horrible thing about Twitter and all the rest of it, about muting and everything else, and I do a bit in this on the power of information, is that you get self-induced groupthink, because all these people who are out there who've got their personal view, the majority of them, if they don't like someone else's view, they block them. So all of a sudden, everything that comes into their feed is only people that are supporting their views, and they think, oh, therefore my view must be right. But it's not. You're self-inducing your own level of groupthink that's in there if you don't listen to alternative arguments, which is why I'll quite happily have alternative arguments and force them every now and again with these little blame bombs.
But I love that. I would never have thought that, but you're dead right. I didn't realize that. I never looked at it from that point of view, but that's really interesting. And it makes complete sense. Yeah, the block and And then, and that's actually concerning, because you go into the world then thinking only your views matter.
Correct.
You get some land when somebody then disagrees with you in the real world, because you can block them on Twitter. You can't block reality in the living. So, yeah.
Can you just remind everyone that's listening what two books are how they get hold of them?
Myself and Karen Whelan, we just completed our short book in the lockdown. We needed to do something that was productive, and trying to fit that in around, you know, homeschooling and children and just having a life and looking after a lot of people. We got it finished. We finished it, and it was probably a much bigger book. It was text heavy. And I just said to Karen, I love Amazon's reads, you know, 30 minute reads.
Yep.
Because I love to read an actual book. I like audiobooks, but I also like to read a book. I like holding a book in my hand, and I like Kindle version too. And I just said to Karen, I said, do you know what? This book is not really ideal for somebody like me. And she was like, what do you mean? And I was like, this is really, it's time consuming. It feels like it's a lot to read for people right now. I don't think people have so much time. So she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I think we need to pare it back, cut back on the text, and make it more condensed, not a 30-minute read, but like a 3-hour read for people. So we both recorded our versions of the book for Audible. It's a 3-hour read. So I said, that's what I wanted. So people could come in, it's short and snappy, and hopefully people that are like me, that are under pressure when it comes to family life and everything else, can pick up the book or download it on Kindle, because it's Kindle at the moment. It will be paperback, and then it'll be hopefully in the bookstores this summer. It'll be kind of like a pocket-sized book when it's printed off for the bookstores. And hopefully people will just go, it'll be one of those books that they can read in like 3 hours. They feel like they've gotten something from it. And at the same time, then we have brought Social Anxiety Ireland on board to be... to benefit from each book sale. So they'll get a euro from every book that's sold.
Oh,
and that will continue even when the print version is in bookstores. And the reason we chose them is because they don't get any funding. They rely solely on donations. Their Orrin McCarthy is the clinical psychologist behind it. And he's had phenomenal success with his clinical psychologist team, who are all volunteers. and give their time for free. And so far today, they've treated 800 people with social anxiety in Ireland.
Oh, fantastic.
And there's 400,000 people in this country with social anxiety. So that's why we chose them.
For people that are listening, the book is called No More Anxiety, and you've written it with your friend Karen Whelan, isn't that right?
Yeah, but it's actually called, it's really funny. It's called Sunday Morning Cure, No More Anxiety. But Philip, people keep hanging on to the anxiety part. Like you, people keep saying, no more anxiety. And I'm like, but it's actually Sunday Morning Cure, No More Anxiety. And the reason I went with Sunday Morning Cure was the idea when I used to drink, I wasn't a big drinker, but if I woke up on a Sunday morning after drinking the night before, I don't drink anymore, obviously. But when I did, I could never handle alcohol because I'm just a lightweight. And also, I am. And I just don't have a tolerance. But I've since learned there's a reason for that too, a physical reason. But I used to wake up the next morning and like Google a cure. I need a cure. What can I take for my body? And my anxiety would be through the roof and I would just be feeling crap. And then I'd want somebody else to sympathize with me that they were feeling the very same. And that's where Sunday Morning Cure came out and No More Anxiety, because I had woeful anxiety after a drinking session. And I could drink only 3 times a year. But it was like enough to put the fear of God in me. I wouldn't drink for months afterwards.
I think most of us know of that Sunday morning feeling, Saturday morning feeling, or whatever morning feeling, and it's that never again. Yeah. Unfortunately, most of us probably don't have the discipline that you've got of properly doing never again.
Well, I don't know if it's discipline. I think it got to the case for me, Philip, was that I just couldn't keep doing it. I think for me was. The realization came when I realized I wasn't actually enjoying drinking. So I'd be out on a night out and my awareness became very strong on a night out where I would be drinking and then I get to the third drink and I go, actually, I'm really uncomfortable right now. I don't feel relaxed. I actually feel my anxiety is getting higher. I used to think it calmed my anxiety and it was like something for me to get through a social situation. Now, my social situations were only impacted on a night out in a pub or a nightclub or a wedding, like where people would be drinking around.
Yeah, because you got quite a high profile public persona. And again, for you're in Ireland. So describe a little bit about where you are in Ireland for people that are listening in and your professional persona.
Well, my first book, I think you can get copies from me actually on myself and Karen Whelan's website, yournovalife.com, if you want a signed copy of my book. Then there's Sunday Morning Cure, No More Anxiety is available on Amazon Kindle at the moment. And it's also going to be on paperback in a few weeks through Amazon. And then bookstores in Ireland this summer. I don't know yet about the UK, so I'm not sure how that's going to work. We haven't expanded our thoughts just yet.
I think we're not allowed to import stuff across the border anymore. That's been banned.
Well, anyway, there you go. So I know I just it's just there. It's a short, snappy book, and at the end of the day, if it's an interest to you, you might find it, you know, a worthwhile read, or you might go that was shit. I didn't enjoy that. That's okay too. You know, we don't take offense. We put stuff out there. We don't force it. That's something myself and Karen have always felt, that nothing should be forced. And I just like putting stuff out. And if people want to connect with it, they can connect with it. And equally, they don't have to.
Well, but it's so important to sort of stimulate people to try and think in a different way. And I think from what I've seen of the synopsis of the book and others, it certainly does that. And therefore add real value to those people that have got open minds.
Yeah, I think it will. I think there's people that live in the gray area, people that are not an alcoholic, say, but they're sober curious. And they're also, they didn't realize they were suffering with social anxiety. And then they read the book and they realized, actually, this relates to how I was feeling. This relates to why. And then they can put two and two together and probably free themselves from whether it's alcohol or from the eating too much, junk when they really don't want anymore. There's loads of different things they can connect it to. It's not just about alcohol or that. It's about kind of recognizing your own inner strength and just being happy within yourself and your own skin. And I think that's the message of the book as well, is just standing in your own power and being comfortable in the discomfort. And you know what? That's the thing, going behind the veil and not being afraid to actually let yourself be seen. And that's what a lot of people are afraid of, to be seen. They're afraid if they're seen, then people won't like them or they're not enough. And that's our biggest fear. So if you can lift the veil, be seen, and go, this is me. Whether you like it or not, I like it. And this is this is it. I can't change who I am. I'm supposed to be this way. And not everyone's going to like it. And that's also okay, because we're all supposed to have different conflicts. I don't mean war or fighting, but a little bit of conflicts within ourselves, because there's going to be something in you that mirrors back to me that I might not like within myself. But that's okay. You're just showing a mirror to me that I need to go work on something within myself. And that's how I see things. I don't get angry at people anymore. You know, it's important when we're mirroring back to other people, we do so with compassion and kindness as well.
Yeah, exactly. So what's your next project?
I don't know. I think, you know what, just enjoying the moment and just being grateful, trying to find gratitude in this craziness. That's what I've been trying to do every day, going, I'm grateful. It's crazy, but look at the mountains at the back of my house. Thank you, God. Thank you for the mountains. This is what I say to myself whenever I feel a level of anxiety. I look out the window and I can see my mountains. I'm just going, be thankful, be thankful. Your kids are well, you're well, just be grateful. And if you can take each step at a time, each day at a time, so many of, you know, we're looking ahead all the time, and that makes us more anxious, because that's like a loss of control. Whereas if you can just work with right now, if anything my losses have taught me is that all we have, because anything can change in an instant, but at the same time, don't fear that. Live in the joy, find peace within the joy. We're so afraid to feel joyful because we're afraid that it's going to be ripped from us and taken from us in an instant. And I had to work with that because so much had been taken from me in an instant. Now I just work with the joy. And I just go, it's okay. This is okay to feel joyful. It's okay to just love. I love looking at my children's faces. That's huge for me. Yeah. Looking at their little face and going, thank you for this. Thank you for them. That's where I find my joy.
Yeah. And lockdown is the perfect time for all of us to start to really enjoy where we are and what we've got around us. And isn't nature and isn't local nature fantastic? We don't need to be jumping an aircraft and flying thousands of miles to lie on a beach with 45,000 million other people.
But I love that how you talked about in the article in the newspaper, how you spoke about your, this is just like, you know, for you, this isn't as big of a deal for you being in a lockdown.
Well, exactly. Yes. You know, as I say to people, it's just like being in operations, except you've got good food. You've got as much booze as you want. Your internet connection is fantastic, as is your phone connection. You can have as much Netflix and access to books as you want. Oh, and nobody's trying to shoot you or rocket you. So that's a bonus.
We all need to think a little like that. Yeah.
Brilliant. Hey, Angela, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
I've really loved it. Thank you so much. I've just loved it.
Thank you for listening. Please feel free to share if you like what you've heard, and I look forward to being with you next time.